15 years, I'm going to now 5 years now. And physically, you know, technically, practically, you know, technically, I feel like I'm 38, 39, but practically, I feel like I'm still in my 20s. This mentality, you can see in my behavior, the way I talk, the way, that's who I am actually. So we have, there's a huge gap. And when I was released, different society, language, community, anyone and get interact or friend with get arrested, interrogated, people stay away from us. So because the stigma of Guantanamo. So basically, but I'm trying now, I'm trying to make a life, get married. Yeah, I can sing a song for you.
Yes, you said you'd sing too.
Yeah, the first one when we like supporting, because especially when General Miller arrived, he tried to crush us. The first day he arrived, he searched all of us, beat all of us. Cavity search, you know, they put dogs, ipsy thieves.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
Camera activist Betty Lee has captured 30 years of street protests in Portland, from the 1989 demonstration condemning the racist murder of Mulla Gaita Sirah to the Black Lives Matter protests of 2020. The Old Mole Variety Hour is pleased to offer a large print of your choice of Betty's most iconic photos to 10 lucky donors during KBOO's fall membership drive. Winners will be selected by lottery, and everyone who donates will be eligible. For more details and to see Betty's photos, go to kboo.fm/BETTELEE. Every Monday morning at 9 a.m., the Old Mole Variety Hour gnaws at the roots of our capitalist system with views, reviews, and interviews that you can sink your teeth into. Music by Lion Rhythms.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, Oregon Republicans show up to the Capitol after a weekend boycott over redistricting. Oregon kids are now more likely to be infected with COVID-19 than elderly age groups. And the DEA issues a public safety alert warning of fentanyl-laced counterfeit prescription pills. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 27th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our fall fun drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Althea Billings. 16 House Republicans returned to the Oregon Capitol in Salem on Monday morning, suggesting a vote is likely on new district maps for the state. The Republicans' presence gives House Democrats the two-thirds quorum they need to conduct business. Over the weekend, only one Republican showed up to the Capitol, denying Democrats the quorum they needed to advance their proposed maps. Republicans say the congressional maps are unfairly stacked against their party. Today is the deadline for both the House and the Senate to determine the voter makeup of the districts for the U.S. House, for the State House, and the State Senate for the coming decade. If no map is agreed upon, Democratic Secretary of State Shamia Fagan would be the next in line to draw 90 new House and Senate districts. A panel of 5 current or former judges still to be named would be tapped to draw 6 new congressional districts. House Speaker Tina Kotek, who's a Democrat, warned Republican House members that if enough of them did not show up by 9:30 a.m. today, she would pull the plug on redistricting. After Kotek verified that a quorum was present, lawmakers recessed so that a House committee could amend the congressional redistricting bill to reflect the new compromise. Democrats' new congressional district proposal, which they offered to Republicans late last week, would create 3 extremely safe Democratic seats, 1 extra safe Republican seat, and 1 seat that tilts in Democrats' favor, and 1 seat that is a virtual 50-50 tie. The district that shows as 50-50 would include the fast-growing Bend, where expected Democratic growth could make the district bluer over the next decade. The nonpartisan group PlanScore found in its statistical analyses of the Democrats' latest electoral maps that they would result in relatively representative districts, with a slightly disproportionate benefit for Democrats in the state Senate and slightly disproportionate benefits for Republicans in the state House. The Oregon Health Authority reported 3,606 new COVID-19 cases over the weekend, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases to 320,990. Oregon health officials also reported 27 new deaths, raising the state's death toll to 3,709 people. There's currently a 9% availability for both adult ICU beds and non-ICU beds statewide. An analysis of COVID-19 cases by the Oregonian found that in September, coronavirus case rates among Oregon children aged 9 and younger were slightly higher for someone in their 60s or older, something that has never been true before. Young children remain far less likely to be infected than teens, and most adults and young children with infections remain unlikely to be hospitalized or die. Out of more than 18,000 confirmed pediatric infections, just 2 fatalities, both infants, have occurred in Oregon. However, in recent months, the spread of coronavirus has skewed more heavily toward young children, especially in September, coinciding with schools reopening. Kids are also making up a growing share of total monthly cases. Nearly 9% of Oregon's cases this month are among children 9 and younger, a share not previously seen in cases from earlier months. All combined, Oregonians 19 and younger account for about 22% of recorded cases in September. Last week, Pfizer released the results of a trial showing that its COVID vaccine was safe and generated a robust antibody response in children aged 5 to 11. Federal regulators have suggested a vaccine for that age group could be available by Halloween. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration issued its first public safety alert in 6 years today, warning of a nationwide surge in fentanyl-laced counterfeit prescription pills. The Seattle Division of the DEA said that the confiscation of fake pills that contained lethal doses of fentanyl increased by 275% between October 2020 and this month in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Alaska. In Oregon, the DEA seized about 95,000 counterfeit pills between October of 2019 and September of 2020. In the current fiscal year that ends this month, the number of counterfeit pills in the state skyrocketed to 340,000, possibly the highest annual yield in Oregon history. According to data from the state medical examiner, the state also reported the most deaths ever from fentanyl in 2020. For the first time, the drug eclipsed heroin as the second leading cause of overdose deaths in Oregon. The public safety alert from the DEA warns against buying and taking any pills sold outside of licensed pharmacies, which are illegal and potentially lethal. The alert does not apply to legitimate pharmaceutical medications prescribed by medical professionals and dispensed by licensed pharmacists. The legitimate prescription supply chain has not been impacted by this. The DEA adds in their statement, quote, "Anyone filling a prescription at a licensed pharmacy can be confident that the medications they receive are safe when they're taken as directed by a medical professional," end quote. Disgraced R&B star R. Kelly was convicted today in a sex trafficking trial after decades of avoiding criminal responsibility for numerous allegations of sexual misconduct with young women and children. A jury made up of 7 men and 5 women found 54-year-old Kelly guilty on all 9 counts, including sex trafficking and racketeering, on their second day of jury deliberation. Prosecutors argued that the entourage of managers and aides who helped Kelly meet girls and keep them quiet amounted to a criminal enterprise. Two people have already been charged along with Kelly in a separate federal case that's pending in Chicago. At the trial, several of Kelly's accusers testified without using their real names to protect their privacy and prevent possible harassment by the singer's fans. Jurors were also shown homemade videos of Kelly engaging in non-consensual sexual acts. Kelly was also convicted of criminal counts accusing him of violating the Mann Act, which makes it illegal to take anyone across state lines for, quote, any immoral purpose. Additionally, Kelly has pled not guilty to sexual misconduct-related charges in Illinois and Minnesota. Trial dates in those cases have not yet been set. Assistant U.S. Attorney Maria Cruz Melendez argued that Kelly was a serial abuser who, quote, maintained control over these victims using every trick in the predator handbook. Kelly has been jailed without bail since 2019. The trial was delayed by the coronavirus pandemic and a last-minute shakeup of his legal team. Kelly now faces up to 20 years in prison. His sentencing is scheduled for May 4th. Climate scientists say drought, mega fires, and air pollution are becoming more extreme and more common because of climate change. The U.S. House is planning to vote this week on an infrastructure bill which would speed up the switch to renewable energy. Suzanne Potter has more on the story with the Public News Service.
The U.S. House of Representatives is supposed to vote this week on President Joe Biden's Build Back Better infrastructure bill, which contains significant resources to fight climate change. Now, a group called Business Forward is highlighting the costs that fires, floods, and extreme heat linked to climate change have imposed on American companies. Business Forward President Jim Doyle says business leaders have direct knowledge of the price we're paying for climate change now.
Severe weather and extreme temperatures are spiking commodity prices, disrupting supply chains, damaging plants and equipment, and messing with consumer demand for their products.
The infrastructure bill would hasten the switch to renewable energy. Doyle notes that in 2019, California imported 80% of the fossil fuels it consumed. He claims that by switching to renewables in-state, the Golden State could create a $79 billion opportunity to buy local energy. According to CAL FIRE, more than 7,600 blazes have consumed more than 2.4 million acres in the Golden State this year. Some estimates put the damage as high as $17 billion. Todd Vogel co-owns Eastside Sports in Bishop and says all the smoke has led to a big drop in the number of tourists.
We're completely dependent on people traveling here. It's very much an outdoor-based tourism economy, dependent on backpacking and fishing and skiing. As we feel more of the consequences of climate change, particularly with the fire seasons, we've seen visitation drop off dramatically.
Business Forward has launched a $1.2 million radio ad campaign this week aimed at pressuring lawmakers in swing districts to help pass the infrastructure bill, including Congressman Jim Costa from Fresno. This is Suzanne Potter reporting.
U.S. gymnasts are confronting sexual abuse in their sport. Prevention advocates say it's a reminder that prevention can start closer to home for Idaho communities. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story.
Simone Biles and other U.S. gymnasts are confronting sexual abuse in their sport, including at a Senate Judiciary Committee this month. Now, with school sports back in session, sexual abuse prevention advocates want people to think about prevention methods closer to home. Roger Sherman is head of the Idaho Children's Trust Fund, a state affiliate of Prevent Child Abuse America. He says abuse prevention is not so much about finding predators as it is about minimizing the opportunities abusers might have.
The important thing for us to recognize is that this is fully preventable, but we have to put systems in place to make sure that if there are predators, they are not able to take advantage of children, of our children.
Some protections are in place for young athletes, including the Safe Sport Authorization Act, which was passed in 2017 in response to the USA Gymnastics sexual abuse scandal surrounding team doctor Larry Nassar. But Sherman notes parents can go further. He says they should ask teams and schools how they are addressing abuse prevention, noting that his and other organizations in the state provide education and training.
The kind of training that we think is important for preventing child sexual abuse is training first around learning the facts. Second is around minimizing the opportunity. Third is being willing to talk about it.
Sherman says abuse can be debilitating, leaving lasting scars for those who are abused.
You can heal, and that's important to know, but it's better if it never happens, and that's really what our job as adults is. That's what our job as parents is. You know, our job is to ask the right questions and to make sure that the adults responsible for our kids are doing the right thing.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
You are listening to a special fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can become a member or renew your KBOO membership at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact. Historians Dana Ramey Berry and Kaylee Nicole Gross are talking about their new book, A Black Woman's History of the United States, honoring the many significant contributions of Black women who have worked tirelessly to build this country and fight for social justice in the face of racism and sexism. Then at 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be rainy with a low of 55 degrees. That rain continues tomorrow with a high of 62. Today in history, in 1779, the Continental Congress appoints John Adams to travel to France to negotiate treaties of peace and commerce with Great Britain during the Revolutionary War. The quote of the day is from American abolitionist and statesman Frederick Douglass, who said, quote, "If there is no struggle, there is no progress." A government shutdown looms as the Senate prepares to vote on the debt ceiling, the U.S. reopens a border crossing in Texas, and an Amtrak train crash kills 3 in Montana. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
In just 8 months, Joe Biden and the radical Democrats are well on their way to turning America into a third world nation. That's what's happening.
Former President Donald Trump held a rally in Georgia with retired running back Herschel Walker. Walker plans to challenge incumbent Democratic Senator Raphael Warnock. But election officials there say Trump could be charged with breaking the law after trying to overturn Joe Biden's Georgia victory. The Senate will hold a vote tonight on a plan to fund the government through December 3rd and increase the debt limit. Without a higher debt limit and short-term funding, federal agencies could close this week, a serious threat to the economy. But Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell says Republicans won't vote to raise the debt ceiling. Early vote totals from Sunday's parliamentary election show Germany's two largest parties in a dead heat. The center-left Social Democrats took slightly under 25%, just 0.2 percentage point ahead of outgoing Chancellor Angela Merkel's center-right Christian Democrats. German Marshall Fund fellow reporter Marcus Zehner says with no dominant party, it will take time to put together a ruling coalition.
Last time we had elections in 2017, it actually took a half a year. Angela Merkel will leave the office only when there's a successor.
U.S. officials are reopening a border crossing in southern Texas that had been closed for more than a week. The port of entry at Del Rio was shut after thousands of migrants set up camp below the international bridge. It should be open to cargo traffic today. Meanwhile, Texas Governor Greg Abbott defended Border Patrol agents seen charging at migrants on horseback, saying he would hire them if they were fired. At least 3 people were killed Saturday afternoon when an Amtrak train between Seattle and Chicago derailed in Montana. Several of the train cars toppled on their sides. An Amtrak statement said there were multiple injuries. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky has overruled advisors to endorse booster shots for healthcare workers, teachers, and others.
In a pandemic, we most often take steps with the intention to do the greatest good, even in an uncertain environment. And that is what I'm doing with these recommendations.
Her decision supports a White House push to put boosters into more arms. President Biden announced last week that a third dose of the Pfizer vaccine will be available to people ages 65 and older, as well as adults at elevated risk. Pfizer's CEO said over the weekend that first doses of the vaccine and the booster can be given simultaneously. Yahoo News reports in 2017 the CIA considered kidnapping and/or assassinating Julian Assange. According to Rolling Stone, some former Trump officials were so concerned by the proposal, drafted under Director Mike Pompeo, they felt the need to go to Congress. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
California's governor signs a package of Native American bills, and the mayor of Albuquerque apologizes for Indian boarding schools. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. California Governor Gavin Newsom has signed 6 wide-ranging tribal bills introduced by Assemblymember James Ramos. One of the bills creates a monument honoring tribes on the grounds of the state capitol in Sacramento. It also removes a provision in state law requiring maintenance of a controversial statue of Junipero Serra, founder of the California Mission System. The sculpture stood on Capitol grounds from April 1967 to July 2020, when it was toppled by protesters. Native people say the statue of Serra represents the mission period of genocide, slavery, and other abuses imposed on California Indians. Ramos and members of the Central California Tribal Chairpersons Association urged for the bill's passage this summer. Ramos and tribal leaders talked about the importance of telling their history.
It's time for us and our voice of the California Indian people to be elevated, to bring attention to these issues of the Spanish missionary period and how much destruction is meant to our people, as well as other areas that now we're touching into, the boarding schools and that dark period of history. Now is the time for us to gather together in one accord and through unity to let our voices be heard. And it's not just about our voices here today. It's about our ancestors and our elders that are buried in the ground in the state of California, that it's also time for their voice to be heard of what truly happened to them in the state of California.
A number of tribes and Native organizations supported the statue bill. Ramos is the first California Native American elected to the legislature. The other bills signed by California's governor involve tribal foster youth, students' right to wear traditional dress to graduation, a paid holiday for state court personnel on California Native American Day, and streamlined access to emergency response vehicles on tribal lands. Newsom signed the legislative package on California Native American Day Friday. Over the weekend in New Mexico, the city of Albuquerque apologized for Indian boarding schools. The city says it's a step toward reconciliation and is working with the Native community on recommendations to honor students at a burial site of the Albuquerque Indian School in 4-H Park. Mayor Tim Keller joined members of the Commission on American Indian and Alaska Native Affairs Saturday for a public acknowledgement and apology on behalf of the city.
We are here today to show respect for a sacred site. I want to acknowledge the intergenerational trauma that persists from centuries of oppression and erasure, and to express our deepest apologies on behalf of the city of Albuquerque for the grievous actions over the past decades that have occurred against Native American communities right here in the city.
The city acquired the park in the 1970s and took over maintenance of land known to be the burial site of the Indian school. The Presbyterian Church ran the Indian school in the late 1880s. It was later transferred to federal control and operated until 1981. Kyle Tapaha represented the Albuquerque Commission on American Indian and Alaska Native Affairs.
We must continue to participate in heartfelt, meaningful discussions and engage in productive dialogue with each other. We must continue to work to address and resolve these challenges together using our renewed partnerships.
The city is conducting research on the site and plans to use ground-penetrating radar. The city is also marking off a portion of the park to show respect for the sacred site and removing it from park uses. Orange flags will serve as a temporary demarcation until more permanent ones are finalized. The site is open for ceremonies and practices. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Rikers Island could become a renewable energy hub. The notorious jail on the island is slated to close by 2027. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. New York's notorious jail on Rikers Island is expected to close by 2027, and the site could next be used to produce clean energy. New York City Council has passed legislation calling for research on the potential for solar arrays, wind turbines, and battery storage on Rikers. This comes after years of advocacy by environmental justice groups and formerly incarcerated people. Rebecca Bratsbys runs the Center for Urban Environmental Reform at the City University of New York School of Law. She says the next chapter of Rikers Island could benefit the same minority communities that have been harmed by over-policing and inhumane treatment at the jail. She says many of these communities are also burdened by over-pollution.
They have the waste transfer stations and the bus depots and the power plants.
Of particular concern are highly polluting peaker power plants, which kick on when energy demand surges. Bratsbys says if renewable energy from Rikers Island can fill the gap instead, the peaker plants could close.
We now have the opportunity to use this island that has become infamous with human rights abuses to build a better, fairer, safer New York.
Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
The budget reconciliation bill in Congress includes major investments in the transition to clean energy. Democrats are hoping to iron out the bill's details and vote on it this week. Eric Tegedoff has more.
Democrats in Congress are aiming to have legislation passed by the end of September that could have big implications for the climate. Congress is debating what to include in a $3.5 trillion budget reconciliation bill. Senator Patty Murray of Washington State praises the state's action to move toward 100% clean energy by 2045, but says more needs to be done to address climate change.
We cannot ignore this. Washington State has taken some great steps forward, but this is going to take a national step forward on this, and we've got to be part of it.
The Senate already has passed a bipartisan $1 trillion infrastructure bill that includes action on climate change as well. Progressive members of the House have tied the bill to the budget reconciliation measure, saying they won't agree to pass one without the other. The reconciliation bill needs only a simple majority in the Senate to pass, but some moderate Democrats in both House and Senate have balked at its price tag. One key climate action in the budget bill is the Clean Electricity Energy Program, which would create incentives for utility companies to transition to clean energy with federal investments over the next decade. Murray sees it as a critical part of the bill.
We need this historic clean energy payment program that will really move us to reducing carbon emissions. That's the key essential goal we have to meet in order to change the actions of what climate is happening to us.
One analysis found the program could add nearly 8 million jobs over the next decade. Senator Joe Manchin, a West Virginia Democrat still on the fence about the reconciliation bill, wants to slow the proposed rate at which utilities are required to make the clean energy transition. Nonetheless, Murray says action on climate change must happen soon.
Every day we delay, every month we delay, every year we delay is much more expensive and hard to do changes we need to make to meet the urgencies of this time.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
You are listening to a special fall fun drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Monday, September 27th, 2021. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobunoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Suzanne Potter, Nadia Ramlagan, Eric Tegedoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Too Much Information with Abe and Tracy, covering politics and current events while taking listener calls. At 9, tune in to Alternative Radio, which features lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, it's Times Like Now with host Trevor Collins. Then at 11:30, it's Art Focus. Aurora Josephson interviews ceramic artist and author Babawage Jakite about Black Lives Matter, Pan-Africanism, and the family vegetable garden. All of our KABU programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KABU is in our fall fund drive, which means that now is a great time to become a member and support your local community radio station. If you'd like to contribute to KABU, you can go to kabu.fm/give or text KABU to 44321. Stay tuned now for Making Contact.
Making contact. This is Making Contact. I'm Anita Johnson. Ever since the first Africans were brought to North America on cargo ships, Black women have helped build this country, now known as the United States of America. While Black women have played a critical role in the development of our nation, their stories, our stories, have been overlooked and intentionally left out of history books. In the new book, A Black Woman's History of the United States, historians Dr. Dinah Rami Berry and Dr. Callie Nicole Gross honor the many significant contributions of Black women who have worked tirelessly to build this country and fight for social justice in the face of racism and sexism. Today, we'll learn about some of these amazing women.
There was no way we could write a book and not feature Shirley Chisholm. Mm-hmm. Unbought and unbossed.
What I like about her is her speech when she does the acceptance speech, or when she says that she's going to be the nominee. She's running for president. She makes that announcement. And she says, I'm not the candidate for Black America, although I'm Black. I'm not the candidate for the women's America, although I'm a woman. I'm a candidate, there's another sentence, and then she says, I'm the candidate for the people of America. And it's just a really powerful moment, and it just reminds me of the level of activism when we look at Black women last year on the campaign trail. We look at the number of Black women that were being considered for the vice presidency, and we have a Black and South Asian woman now, Vice President Harris. So that you just think about that, and I think about Shirley Chisholm sort of paving the way for these contemporary women. And so we had to include her in here.
That's Dr. Dinah Rami Berry. She, along with Dinah Rami Berry, joined KPFA's moderator, Sabrina Jacobs, for an insightful conversation about the Black women activists, trailblazers, and others who have left a notable mark on this country. Dr. Callie Nicole Gross.
So in thinking about how we're going to do this, right? Well, on one hand, we know that Black women and Black women's experiences, they're not a monolith, right? And we wanted to make sure that we talked about all kinds of Black women, from enslaved women to free women, women in rural parts of the country, women from the South, in urban areas, the North, Midwest, West Coast, you name it, all walks of life. But in spite of all of their differences, there are a number of themes that seem to impact Black women's experiences in broadly. And so we decided that this would also be some of the organizing principles for the book. I mean, you see them here laid out. Travel, motion, and migration is a huge aspect of Black women's experiences, whether that's forced migration, whether Black women chose, elected to leave, but, you know, I say voting with their feet, right? Taking advantage, you know. Violence is obviously an inescapable aspect of Black womanhood. We looked at that in a lot of ways, certainly physical violence, sexual violence, but also thinking too about representational violence, the ways that Black women are caricatured and ridiculed, also the violence of poverty. The other theme we worked on was certainly activism is a central facet. From the first sister who, you know, chose to come, you know, and on an exploration, which Diana will talk more about, right up until today, Black women have been demanding justice, have been decrying inequity, and are fierce advocates and will stand up and organize. Labor and entrepreneurship are also vital aspects. And again, we try to approach that broadly, thinking about their experiences with respect to enslavement, but also ways that they branched out and tried to cultivate their own careers to escape agricultural labor and domestic service and other kinds of labor that was exploitative even after enslavement. The other big sort of change, not change, but one of the other streams that we really wanted to incorporate is looking at criminalization and incarceration. I think a lot of times when we think about these issues around justice and mass incarceration, we tend to approach this as something that uniquely happens to Black men. And one of the things that we find in history is that Black women were actually more disproportionately overrepresented in the justice system than Black men. And that's something that begins in the North, almost from the country's founding, when they gradually, you know, phase out enslavement. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the whole country, including the South, once we have the Civil War. So that was a key piece to also sort of really tease out too, to see how deeply embedded these biases and misogynoir really is in the country. But at the same time, you know, we didn't want to put together a history that would be sort of this one-sided kind of slog through violence and terror and tyranny. We also wanted to capture Black women's vibrancy, that spirit, the passion that keeps folks going. So we also focused on art, performance, creativity. And this is all throughout the book, throughout all these different aspects of history. So not just as soon as we get to like 1975, or all of a sudden we're talking about artists or something. No, artists are in the antebellum period. They are in the late 19th century, the early 20th century, you know, creativity, performance, all these things to just sort of highlight the ways that people indulge and express themselves and also a love for their Black womanhood. And then, of course, in thinking about sex and sexuality, we wanted to explore pleasure, right? That we talk a lot about sex and violence and terror and these things that happen to Black women. We know a lot about Black women's bodies as victimized bodies, but we also wanted to explore Black womanhood's experience with respect to sexuality and the erotic, and also too with different sexual identities. So we took pains to make sure that we represented the experiences of Black queer women, and again, throughout history. So we don't wait until we get into the 70s to start talking about Black lesbians. We talk about Black queer experiences in the antebellum period, the late 19th century, the 20th century, right up to. So these are sort of the central themes that we structure the book around and what we sort of took pains to accomplish.
And Dinah, Dr. Avery, would you like to go ahead and answer? We've already got a question here. So.
Yeah. So we had a question that from Lavinia Harrison asking, why is family or motherhood not included as a central theme? It's actually not listed as a central theme, but it is absolutely a theme that is throughout the entire book. And one of the things that we will talk about is all of the mothers that we write about in the book that really did phenomenal things under extreme duress and stress. The women that raised children after being the product of rape during slavery, The women and mothers like Mamie Till Mobley, who had the open casket for her son, Emmett Till, which we'll talk about. And we talk about the mothers of the conjoined twins, Millie and Christine McCoy. So mothers are there. We just didn't have it listed as a theme, but there's no way when you read the book that you'll see that motherhood and family is absolutely a central theme. We just used the ones that Dr. Gross was talking about. That was how we sort of framed the argument. We knew we needed to talk about those. We tried to talk about each of those in every chapter, and motherhood was just naturally there. So hopefully that answers your question. And I don't know if you wanted to add to that, Callie, or anything.
No, I mean, I would agree. I think that is, in some respects, right. It was sort of naturally there and throughout. And it comes and occurs through all of the stories and many, many of the chapters.
And sure. Literally, I always say, because my area of expertise is slavery, is that, you know, not all women, even in the post-slavery era, even today, not all women choose to be mothers, not all women want to be mothers. And so we always leave a space for that as well. Or some women were forced to be mothers and not really, you know, and having to raise children that they struggled with raising. So there's that, when we talk about motherhood, we have to look at all the complexities of it and some of the challenges there. So I want to jump to Isabel de Oliveira, who opens up the first chapter. And she is a figure who we did about a year of research on to find out who this woman was. We were trying to figure out, where do we start this book? Where do we start in 1619 with the first ship that came, that we talk about all the time, that now lots of people know about? Or do we go a little bit earlier? Are there women of African descent that were here earlier? And if so, where were they? What were they doing? What are their stories? Isabel de Oliveira is one such woman who we were very happy to write about, and other scholars have written about her as well. She was a woman of both African and Indian descent. She lived in Mexico, and she wanted to go on an expedition to travel with a number of other explorers that were going into what now is, it was New Spain. It was called New Spain, but it's present day New Mexico. And she had to file a petition with the local government, and she had to then have witnesses to testify to whom she was and that she was valid. And that they could validate her going. And she was asking and demanding and requesting a piece of paper to show that she was a free woman and that she was bound neither by marriage nor slavery, and that she could go on this expedition and that people would not bother her. And she wanted to have this documentation to carry with her as sort of that authentication paperwork so that no one would bother her, because she knew that people would be disturbed, as she says, disturbed by her being a mulatta. So that's her. And at the end, she says, you know, I'm going on an expedition and have reason to fear that I may be annoyed. I may be annoyed by some individual since I am a mulatta. I demand justice. And as Dr. Gross was saying a few minutes ago, Black women came to this country demanding justice before 1619. And that was really important for us to start with that time period and to start with a woman who was free, to show that Black people did not just come to this country enslaved, that they had lived in freedom and in spaces of freedom in all parts of the world, and that their captivity brought them to the United States as enslaved people, but not everybody came that way. So that was really important for us to start off with Isabel de Oliveira.
Dr. Dinah Rami Berry.
So when we go into the next section, this is more familiar. This is really where, if you've taken an African-American history class, this is where the textbooks often begin. They begin often in 1619. We've been hearing a lot about it over the last year because of the anniversary, the past anniversary or commemoration of the first arrival of 20-odd, the quote was 20-odd Negroes. So we looked at the women and one woman that was on that particular ship or those ships, and that was Angela. And we really went back to understand, like, where did she come from? What community did she live in? What was her capture like? What was her experience before she landed? Because most of what we know and most of what we teach is after the landing. But there's such a larger history of women on slave ships. And I want to just read a little section, just a quick section about what it might be like to be captured from the first chapter. Consider for a moment that the particular trauma of forced captivity for women. African girls and women might have been tended to children or engaged in other responsibilities in their villages with family and with friends, when suddenly someone with a sackcloth on their head put a sackcloth on their heads and chains on their feet. They were violently taken and forced to walk to places that they did not know existed. When they arrived, some of them saw bodies of water that seemed to have no end. even more frightening was the sight of their captors. This may have been the first time they saw people with white skin. Who were they? Ghosts? Cannibals? Evil spirits? Were their captors European or African? How do women make sense of the process of what was happening, or do they process what was happening? In the midst of all of this confusion, they were forced to walk in quote-unquote slave coffles, chained by neck or ankles to their captives, to other captives, many of whom did not speak the same language, despite the commonality of their skin tone. Those being transported, they may not have been from the same community. African people came from thousands of different ethnicities and spoke a variety of languages. Barefoot and sometimes naked, they were put into holding facilities with cold concrete floors and walls that did not have windows, a suffocating ventilation system. Bodily fluids such as vomit, blood, urine, and feces caked the floor and the walls, and the stench was overwhelming. Speaking sounds of distraught mothers, daughters, aunties, grandmothers, infants, moaning, crying, and screaming were ear-piercing and haunting. This was not a place anyone chose to visit nor cared to remember. It was a place that they all wanted to forget. So that is just a passage of some of the more difficult passages of the book. We actually, if you remember, we struggled. Some of our early openings were a little bit too heavy. And we had to back up. We want people to read the book. But there are some pieces in here and there's sections in here that are challenging. If you haven't read about the institution of slavery, if you don't know much about Black women's experience with incarceration, some of those sections are going to be challenging for the reader. But there's also, as Kelly was saying, there's joy. There's moments of just great creativity and strength. So the whole gamut is in this book. You go to the next, maybe.
Sure.
So I'm going to say a few more things and then we'll shift gears. But the next section we move into, because we kind of go chronologically. So now we're moving into a period in the third chapter where we're talking about Black women and independence. And the main point of this chapter is to show that Black women were fighting for independence from day one. Just as we said with Isabel de Oliveira, they filed for petitions and suits. They went to court. They ran away. They resisted. They did all kinds of things. So that's really the main point. And we've tried to identify how Black women experienced the American Revolution.
Dr. Kylie Nicole Gross.
So we moved through the chapters and get to the Civil War, the end of Civil War. We also talk about Black women's experiences after the Civil War. I don't know if this passage is too long. No, I think you can go. Chapter 6 is called Frances's Sex, The Dawning of the Black Woman's Era, 1876 to 1915. And there's a quote that says, "None of your damn business." It's Frances Thompson. So in 1876, Frances Thompson, a formerly enslaved Black woman, was arrested in Memphis, Tennessee, and fined $50. She had migrated to the area about a decade earlier at a time maybe full of hope and excitement as she began her new life as a free woman in the city. She made friends and lived in a booming Black community. She liked nice dresses, especially those in bright colors. In 1866, she would survive the extraordinary violence that decimated her neighborhood. Just a year after emancipation, Frances would testify before a congressional committee. One of five Black women to tell their stories that day, Frances, who relied on crutches because of a foot malady, described how she had been robbed and gang raped by a group of white men, at least two policemen among them. The men burst into the home she shared with another Black woman, Lucy Smith, and savaged them both. As Frances testified, "They drew their pistols and said they would shoot us and fire the house if we did not let them have their way with us." The Memphis riots, sparked in part by white rage at Black Union soldiers, claimed over 40 African-American lives, as well as 91 homes, 4 churches, and 12 schools, the latter all set ablaze. Untold numbers of Black women and girls likely suffered the same fate as had Frances. But Frances and the other women followed in the footsteps of Black women who reported soldiers' crimes during the Civil War. Specifically, they went on record to state unequivocally that they did not consent. And I want to pause here for a minute because I really, really stretch out and thinking about some of the themes that we talked about and the readings that Diana shared also. we mark this moment where Black women are really laying claim to themselves and their own bodies for the first time as citizens in the country. And a key aspect of that for Black women was the power to say that they did not consent, because up until that point, it was not a crime to rape a Black woman or a Black girl. And that was true for basically either Black or white men. So this was sort of monumental for them to have done that. All right, so I'm just gonna finish up, and I promise you too, it is not much longer. All right, the published congressional report laid bare white's cruelties, and locally, Frances Thompson became persona non grata. For the next decade, she would endure police harassment, accused of everything from distributing hoodoo bags and telling fortunes to being responsible for, quote, infamous traffic as a procuress and keeper of one of the vilest dens in the city, end quote. And there were more serious allegations. According to the Memphis Public Ledger, Frances had been, quote, arrested several times on suspicion of being a man and notorious lewdness, but always managed to escape the clutches of the law, end quote. However, in July of 1876, she did not get away. Though Frances maintained that she was, quote, of double sex, a local white doctor, doubtful of her claims, had her arrested, and after subjecting her to a series of invasive examinations by four physicians, they told authorities that her true sex was male. What did these examinations mean for Frances? One wonders how she coped with such violations. Frances had lived at least 20 years as a woman, donning ladies' hats and gingham overskirts with petticoats, attire fashionable for her day. The finding that her sex was male forced her into male clothes, men's clothes, and onto a male chain gang. Whereas Frances had maintained a smooth face in custody, authorities denied her the ability to shave. And as the day's doings noted, quote, a thick Black beard is coming out all over his face to his great disgust, end quote. As a free woman, Frances had cleaved out a life for herself, weathering seasons that might find her almost in rags or draped in the finest and loud colored toggery. Behind bars, she never suffered her fight, answering rude questions about her gender by responding, quote, none of your damn business. And so these were the kinds of stories and histories. When we talked about writing a Black woman's history for the 21st century, this to me is another great example of what that means. And so she is a part of this continuum of Black women. Another famous with Mary Church Terrell, certainly also, you know, tremendous figure, you know, fighting for suffrage and criminal justice. But we didn't only sort of focus on these folks. We also talked about other kinds of Black women like Augusta Savage, who's another one of my favorite. She was an artist, a sculptress, a Black nationalist. She, you know, she founded a free art school in New York because she also wanted to sort of democratize the process. She went abroad on a fellowship and studied in France. You know, her husband was a Garveyite. One of her second ex-husband was a Garveyite. But she also was a kind of a mover and shaker. You know, she was married and had a child initially very young. You know, then she shed her husband and moved up north and, you know, started referring to her daughter as her sister, started lying about her age, saying she was a decade younger and hanging out with these Harlem Renaissance luminaries and on the jazz scene. So, you know, she was, right. So we talk also about Frances and what art meant to her. Mm-hmm. We also did want to, again, feature the experiences of everyday women. And so we also talk about women who were working as domestics, who were working as sharecroppers in rural parts of the country, how they managed to sort of fight through, especially during the Depression. And again, always, always, always working to sort of feature Black women's voices whenever we can. And just learned so much too in the process about part of Black women's experiences, and also even just sort of the labor of doing that work. I mean, some of the stories are, you know, pretty sad and harrowing. And so it was also important just to check in to figure out how to kind of mediate that, right? Tell those stories and come back from it. But again, we try to talk about all types of women, so even women who desegregate the armed forces, who are among the first to serve. And we also, definitely, this is back to sort of the question I think where someone had raised about mothers. We talk a lot about Black women's experiences in the community in their own way, but also as freedom fighters. And we spend a lot of time talking about women like Mamie Till, Emmett Till's mother, because everyone knows about Emmett Till, but we don't really talk about, you know, Mamie, if she hadn't made this courageous decision, you know, to open up this coffin, we would not know his story. He wouldn't have been that spark, right, that sort of set the, you know, the civil rights movement kind of ablaze. And the thing is that when we study her and talk about her, we realize it was so much more than just making a decision to open that coffin. It was fighting to even reclaim his body from the, you know, officials in the South, because they were intent upon trying to cover it up and bury it. You know, she had to do all of this networking and, you know, mobilizing local officials in Chicago. So you think about when we see these instances of young people murdered violently by racists and how the mothers, the families hardly get a moment to grieve, right, before they have to go to battle to try to get justice. She's one of these very, very early examples of that. So we spend a lot of time talking about Mamie and quoting her and using her words as much as possible. We also quote the parents of the four little girls who died in the church bombing in 1963 in Birmingham. Their mothers also talking about the justice, the pain, the sorrow of that loss.
A virtual question was presented to Dr. Kylie Nicole Gross and Dr. Diana Ramey Berry. The question, Black women's suffrage and negotiating racism of the white women's movement, was that covered in the book?
I mean, we definitely talk about the ways that Black women tried to organize with white women's suffragists, the racism that they encounter. But also, I mean, one of the things that, you know, I love about that our history is that, you know, Black women aren't daunted by these things, right? You know, they know that bias is there and that these alliances are shaky, that white supremacy ultimately, you know, is gonna be a dividing issue for them. So they continue to network and organize their own organizations and clubs. Black women organize voter registration drives. They, you know, collected testimonies and worked with politicians to try to change legislation when it was clear that Black people, once they did get the right to vote, were having their votes, you know, being denied. They fundraised for various candidates, took them around to churches. I mean, you name it. So Black women have championed the right to vote, you know, going as far back as we can remember. But I mean, one of the earliest proponents that most people know is certainly Sojourner Truth, mm-hmm. right? Along with like Frederick Douglass. I mean, you know, okay. Black women have always championed, you know, for these rights and issues. So the thing, I guess I just want to point out too, is some of it also for us was about not wanting to just have a history that's about sort of being in reference to what white folks or white women are doing also, the other piece, right? That we want to center Black women's voices and activism. It doesn't mean that we don't talk about, you know, their encounters with white racists. And also, you know, on those rare instances when they were able to work as allies. But at the end of the day, we were focusing on Black women in the narrative.
Absolutely. Dr. Berry, you want to add anything?
No, I think she said everything. I mean, there's an example that you probably have recently seen because of the suffrage movement, the 19th Amendment anniversary that just passed again.
Yes.
So you heard about Ida B. Wells being told mm-hmm. she had to march in a segregated section of a suffrage parade, and she went right up in there with the other women and had their signs and went right to the front. So Black women don't always respond to the segregation or the disrespect or the marginalization that we're being put in or placed in. And that's so right. I would just say that that's an example of a Black woman saying, no, I'm not marching in the back of this parade. And we are going to come forward because we've been working on this in the trenches just as long as you have. So that's what I would say, is that we were there. And it's not just a book about we were there. It's also about how we were there and what we did when we were there.
You've been listening to A Black Woman's History of the United States on Making Contact. Thanks to the authors, Donna Rami Berry and Callie Nicole Gross. And thank you to KPFA for granting us use of this audio. If you've enjoyed this episode, please write and review us twice on Apple Podcasts, and then please share it with your friends and family via Facebook and on Instagram. We're Making Contact Project. To learn more about us and access other episodes for free, visit radioproject.org. I'm Anita Johnson. Thank you so much for listening to Making Contact.
Welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Laura Wadlin, here with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, Laura.
Our guests this evening are members of the BCTGM Local 364, that's bakers, confectioners, tobacco workers, and grain millers, the Bakers Union at Nabisco Mondelez. Mike Burlingham is the local vice president, and Donna Jo Marks is a shop steward and member of the executive board.